Lecture 2 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Human Values in Education, entitled Incarnation of the Human Being in a Physical Body, given on July 18, 1924. In this lecture course, I want to begin by speaking about how the art of education can be advanced and enriched by an understanding of the human being. Therefore, I will approach the subject as I mentioned in my introductory lecture, when I tried to describe how anthroposophy, in a practical way, can help toward a genuine understanding of the human being, not just the child, but the human being as a whole. I showed how, because spiritual science has an overall knowledge of the whole of human life, from birth to death, to the degree that this takes place on earth, it can correctly show us the essentials of childhood education. It is easy to think that we can know how to educate children by simply observing the events of childhood and youth, but this is not enough. On the contrary, it is like working with a plant. If you introduce a substance to the growing shoot, its effect shows up in the blossom or fruit. It is similar for human life. The effect of what we instill in children during the earliest years or what we draw from them during those years will occasionally appear in the latest years of life. It is seldom realized that when someone develops an illness or infirmity around the age of 50, it has been caused by incorrect methods of teaching during the person's 7th or 8th year. People today usually study the children, though perhaps less externally than I described yesterday, to discover the best ways to help them. This is not enough. Today I would like to lay some foundations on which I will show how we can observe the whole human life by means of spiritual science. Yesterday I said that human beings should be seen as made up of body, soul, and spirit, and I gave some indication of how it is the suprasensory nature of human beings, our higher being, that endures from birth until death, whereas the physical body's substances are always changing. It is essential, therefore, to understand human life in such a way that we see events on earth not as an outcome of life before It is essential, therefore, to understand human life in such a way that we see events on earth as an outcome of life before birth. We have not only the soul qualities within that began at birth or conception, but we also carry pre-earthly soul qualities. Indeed, we even carry the results of previous earthly lives within us. All this is alive and active in us, and during earthly life, we must prepare everything that will eventually pass through the gate of death and live again in the world of soul and spirit beyond earthly life. Consequently, we must come to understand how the suprasensory works into earthly life, because it is present between birth and death. It acts in a hidden way within our bodily nature, and we cannot understand the body if we fail to understand the spiritual forces acting within it. Let us now look at what I have just suggested. We can do this by considering actual examples. Anthroposophic literature, such as my books Theosophy, An Outline of Esoteric Science, and How to Know Higher Worlds, describe ways to understand the human being. Footnote: these three books, along with Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, The Philosophy of Freedom, are considered Steiner's fundamental written works. Please see further reading for these and other references. End of footnote. Let us begin with what leads to a true concrete knowledge of the human being based on anthroposophic statements about humankind and the world. I would like to give you the examples of two people who are certainly familiar to you. I chose them because I studied them both very intensely for many years. These were two men of genius. Later we will consider less gifted individuals. We will see then that anthroposophy does not speak only in general abstract ways, but penetrates real human beings with such understanding that knowledge of the human being is shown to have practical reality for life. By choosing Goethe and Schiller as my examples, and by approaching them indirectly, I hope to show how knowledge of the human being is acquired through spiritual science. Let us consider Goethe and Schiller just as they appeared outwardly during their lives. In each case, we will look at the whole personality. Goethe was an individual who entered life in a remarkable way. Footnote: Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, 1749 to 1832, acquired knowledge of Greek, Latin, French, and Italian as a boy. At about 16, he began to study law. He also studied art, music, anatomy, and chemistry. Goethe's first dramatic success was Götz von Berlichingen, the story of a 16th-century robber baron. It represented his youthful protest against the establishment and a demand for intellectual freedom. The writing of Goethe's Faust, the best known of his works, extended throughout most of his literary life. It was finally finished when he was 81. End of footnote. He was born black, or rather dark blue. This shows how very difficult it was for his spirit to enter physical incarnation. But once this occurred and Goethe had overcome the resistance of this physical body, he was completely in it. On the one hand, it is difficult to imagine a more healthy nature than the boyhood of Goethe. He was amazingly healthy. Indeed, he was so healthy that his teachers found him difficult. Those who present no problem as children seldom enjoy good health in later life. On the other hand, children who are a nuisance to their teachers tend to accomplish more in later life because they have more active and energetic natures. Understanding teachers, therefore, are happy when children keep a sharp eye on them. From his earliest childhood, Goethe was inclined in this way, even in the literal sense of the word. He watched the fingers of someone playing the piano and then named one finger thumby, another pointy, and so on. But beyond this, even in childhood, he was bright and wide awake, and this occasionally gave his teachers trouble. Later in Leipzig, Goethe experienced a severe illness. Bear in mind, however, that certain difficult experiences and sowing of wild oats were needed to bring about a decrease in his health, to the point where he could be attacked by the illness that he suffered in Leipzig. After this illness, Goethe's whole life was one of robust health, but at the same time he was extraordinarily sensitive. He reacted strongly to all kinds of impressions, but he did not allow them to take hold or go deeply into his organism. He did not suffer from heart trouble when deeply moved by some experience, but he experienced any such event intensely. His sensitivity of soul followed him throughout life. He suffered, but his suffering was not expressed as physical illness. Thus his bodily health was exceptionally sound. Furthermore, Goethe felt called upon to show restraint in his way of looking at things. He did not sink into vague mysticism or adopt the frequently held belief that there is no need to look after the outer physical form, but merely gaze at the spiritual. It was just the opposite. To one with Goethe's healthy worldview, spirit and the physical are one. He was alone in understanding that one can observe spirit through the image of the physical. Goethe was tall when he sat and short when he stood. When he stood, you could see that he had short legs. This characteristic is especially important to those who can observe the human being as a whole. Why were Goethe's legs so short? Short legs lead to a certain way of walking. Goethe took short steps because the upper part of his body was heavy and strong, and he placed his foot firmly on the ground. As teachers, we must observe these things so that we can study them in children. Why would a person have short legs and a large upper body? This is an outward indication that in the present earthly life a person can harmoniously express what was experienced in a previous life on earth. Goethe was extraordinarily harmonious in this way. Even in very old age he was able to describe what lay behind his karma. Indeed, he lived to such an advanced age because he was able to bring to fruition the potential gifts of his karma. Even after Goethe left his physical body, it was still so beautiful that those who saw him after his death were filled with wonder. Our impression is that Goethe experienced his karmic potential to the fullest extent. Now nothing is left, and he must begin afresh when he enters an earthly body again under completely different conditions. This is expressed in the particular formation of a body such as Goethe's. The cause of what we bring with us as predispositions from earlier incarnations is revealed mostly in the formation of one's head. Goethe, from the time of his youth, had the beautiful head of an Apollo, from which only harmonious forces flowed down into his physical body. His body, however, was burdened by the weight of its upper part, and his legs that were too short, and this led to his peculiar way of walking, which lasted throughout his life. His whole being was a wonderful, harmonious expression of his karma and karmic fulfillment. Every detail of Goethe's life illustrates this. Such a person, living harmoniously until a ripe old age, must experience outstanding events during middle age. Goethe lived to be 83. He thus reached middle age in 1790, at around 41 years of age. If we consider the years between 1790 and 1800, we have the central decade of his life. Indeed, during that period, Goethe experienced the most important events of his life. Before that time, he found it impossible to formulate his philosophical and scientific ideas in any definite way, important though they were. The Metamorphosis of Plants was first published in 1790. Everything related to it is connected with the decade between 1790 and 1800. In 1790, Goethe was so far from finishing Faust that he published it as a fragment. At the time, he had no idea whether he would ever be able to finish it. During that decade, influenced by his friendship with Schiller, he had the bold idea of continuing Faust. The greatest scenes, including the prologue in Heaven, were from this period. Thus, in Goethe, we see an exceptionally harmonious life, a life that runs its quiet course, undisturbed by inner conflict, and devoted freely and contemplatively to the outer world. By contrast, let us consider the life of Schiller. Footnote: Friedrich von Schiller, 1759 to 1805, wrote several plays before devoting himself to historical studies. In 1794, he established a close friendship with Goethe, who encouraged him to return to writing plays, which led to Wallenstein's Camp, Mary Stuart, The Maid of Orleans, William Tell, and others. In 1799, he moved to Weimar, where he and Goethe collaborated to make the Weimar Theater one of the finest in Germany. Schiller died of tuberculosis at the age of 46. End footnote. From the very beginning, he was placed in a life situation that reveals disharmony between his soul and spirit and his physical body. His head lacked the harmonious formation that we find in Goethe. One could even say that he was ugly, in a way that did not hide his gifts, but ugly nonetheless. In spite of this, his strong personality revealed itself in the way he held himself, and this was also expressed in his features, especially in the formation of his nose. Schiller was not long in body, and he had long legs. On the other hand, everything between his head and limbs, in the area of circulation and breathing, was definitely sick and poorly developed from birth. He also suffered from cramps throughout his life. At first there were long periods between attacks, but later they became almost incessant. They became so severe, in fact, that he could not accept invitations to meals. Instead, he was forced to make it a condition that he would be invited for the whole day, for instance, when he came to Berlin on one occasion, so that he could choose a time when he was free of such pain. The cause of all this was an imperfect development of the circulatory and breathing systems. So, what is the karmic reason from a previous earthly life that causes one to suffer from painful cramps? When pains such as these take hold of one's body, they point directly to karma. If we adopt a sense of earnest scientific responsibility and attempt to investigate these cramp phenomena from the standpoint of spiritual science, we always find a specific karmic cause behind them, the results of actions, thoughts, and feelings from an earlier earthly life. We are faced with this man, and one of two things may arise. On the one hand, everything goes just as harmoniously as it did with Goethe, and we can say that we are dealing with karma. Everything manifests through karma. On the other hand, because of certain conditions that result while descending from the spirit world into the physical, one meets a condition in which the burden of karma cannot be worked through completely. We descend from the spirit world with certain karmic predispositions, and we carry these in us. Imagine that A in this diagram, it's a straight line with an arrow on the right, and there's a little box over the line that says A, and to the right of that a box over the line that says B. They're the same size and everything. Imagine that A in this diagram represents a specific time in the life of a man. At this point, he should be able to realize or fulfill his karma in some way, but for some reason this does not happen. The fulfillment of his karma is interrupted, and a period of time must pass while his karma, quote-unquote, pauses. Fulfillment must be postponed until the next life on earth, and so it goes. Point B becomes another place when he should be able to fulfill his karma in some way, but again he must wait and postpone this aspect of his karma until the next incarnation. When we are forced to interrupt karma in this way, painful cramps can appear in life, and thus we are unable to fully fashion life through our inherent nature. This demonstrates the true nature of spiritual science. It does not indulge in fantasy, nor does it speak in vague, general terms about the four members of the human being, the physical, etheric, astral, and I beings. On the contrary, it penetrates real life and shows the true spiritual causes of various outer manifestations. It shows how we represent ourselves in ordinary life. This is the knowledge that real spiritual science must be able to achieve. Now the question arises, in a life such as that of Schiller, how does karma shape the whole life, if, as it happened in his case, conditions prevent karma from functioning correctly, and thus he has to make continual efforts to accomplish what he wills to do? For Goethe, it was relatively easy to complete his great works. For Schiller, the act of creation was always very difficult. He had to attack his karma, and the way he goes on the attack will not reveal its results until his next earthly life. One day, I had to ask myself, what is the connection between a life such as Schiller's and the more common conditions of life? If we try to answer such a question superficially, nothing significant emerges, even with the help of spiritual scientific research. We cannot spin a web of fantasy. We must observe. Nevertheless, if we approach the first object of observation in a direct way, we will become sidetracked. Thus, I considered the question as follows. How does a life proceed in the presence of karmic hindrances or other pre-earthly conditions? I then began to study certain individuals in whom something like this had already occurred. I will give you an example. There are many similar examples, but I will use one that I can describe exactly. I had an acquaintance, a person who I knew very well in his present earthly life. I was able to establish that there were no hindrances in his life related to the fulfillment of karma. But there were hindrances from what had taken place in his existence between death and rebirth, that is, in the suprasensory life, between his previous earthly life and the one in which I came to know him. In his case, there were not, as there were with Schiller, hindrances that prevent the fulfillment of karma. But there were hindrances that blocked his incorporation of what he experienced between death and a new birth in the suprasensory world. Observing this man, one could see that his experiences between death and a new birth had real significance, but they could not be expressed in earthly life. He had entered karmic relationships with others, and he also incarnated at a time when it was impossible to realize fully what he had, quote-unquote, piled up as the result of, as the substance of his inner soul experience between death and conception. Let me read that sentence again. He had entered karmic relationships with others, and he also incarnated at a time when it was impossible to realize fully what he had, quote-unquote, piled up as the substance of his inner soul experience between death and conception. So, what manifested physically, because this man was unable to realize what had been presented to him in the supersensory world? He stuttered. He had a speech impediment. If we take another step and investigate the causes working in the soul that lead to speech disturbances, we always find that there is a blockage that prevents suprasensory experiences between death and rebirth from entering the physical world through the body. Now the question arises, what is the situation for one who carries very much within him that was brought about through previous karma? It was all stored up in the existence between death and a new birth, and because he cannot bring it into life, he becomes a stutterer. What sort of things are connected with such a person in earthly life? Again and again we could say that this man carries many great qualities gained during pre-earthly life, but he cannot bring them down to earth. He was able to incarnate what he could develop in forming the physical body until the change of teeth. He even had a strong ability to develop what takes place between the change of teeth and puberty. He also developed an outstanding literary and artistic capacity because he had been able to form all that can be developed between puberty and the 30th year. Now, however, for one who has true knowledge of the human being, a deep concern arises, a concern that could be expressed this way. What will be the situation for this person when he enters his 30s, when he should increasingly develop a spiritual or consciousness soul in addition to the intellectual or mind soul? Those who have knowledge of such matters will feel the deepest concern in such cases, because they can see that the consciousness soul, which develops through all that arises in the head, perfect and complete, will be unable to develop fully. For this person, the fact that he stuttered showed that something in the area of the head was not in proper order. Apart from stuttering, this man was as completely sound, with the exception that, in addition to his stutter, which showed that not everything was in order in the head, he suffered from a squint. Again, this indicated that he had been unable to incarnate in this life all that he had absorbed in the suprasensory life between death and rebirth. One day he came to me and said, quote, "I decided to have surgery done for my squint," unquote. I could only say, quote, "If I were you, I would not have it done," unquote. I did everything I could to dissuade him. At the time, I did not see the whole situation as clearly as I do today. What I am describing happened more than 20 years ago, but I was very concerned about this operation. In the end, he did not follow my advice. The operation went ahead, and this is what happened. Shortly after the operation, which was very successful, as such surgery generally is, he came to me in a happy mood and said, quote, "Now I will not squint any more." Unquote. He was a bit vain, as distinguished people frequently are, but I was troubled. A few days later, the man died, having just completed his 30th year. The doctors diagnosed typhoid, but it was not typhoid. He died of meningitis. Spiritual researchers do not need to be heartless when considering such a life. On the contrary, sympathy is deepened. One can nevertheless see through life and comprehend its manifold aspects and relationships. We perceive that spiritual experiences between death and rebirth cannot be brought into the present life, and that this is expressed as physical defects. Unless the right education can intervene, which was impossible in this case, life cannot be extended beyond certain limits. Please do not think I am implying that everyone who squints will die at 30. Negative implications are never intended, and it certainly could happen that other karmic influences will enter life and allow such a person to live to a ripe old age. In this case, however, there was a good reason to be anxious, because the demands placed on the system in the head resulted in squinting and stuttering. One had to ask, how can a person with an organization like this live beyond 35? It is at this point that we must look back at a person's karma. We see immediately that it was not a given that one who has a squint must die at 30. Those who have prepared themselves in pre-earthly life and have absorbed a great deal between death and a new birth may nevertheless be unable to incorporate what they received into physical life. If we consider every aspect of karma in the case I described, we find that certain individuals might very likely live beyond 35. Besides all the other conditions, however, such people would have to possess an impulse that leads to a spiritual view of humankind and the world. This man had a natural disposition for spiritual matters that is rarely encountered, but despite this fact, powerful inherent spiritual impulses from previous earthly lives were too unbalanced, and he was unable to approach the spiritual. I assure you that I can speak of such a matter. I was a close friend of that man, and therefore well aware of the deep cleft between my own world view and his. Intellectually, we could understand each other very well. We could be on excellent terms in other ways, but it was impossible to speak to him of spiritual matters. Consequently, at 35, he would have had to find his way into a spiritual life, otherwise his latent gifts could not be realized on earth. He died when he did because he was unable to accept a spiritual life. It is, of course, quite possible to stutter or have a squint and, nevertheless, continue life as an ordinary mortal. There is no cause for fear as a result of what we must say, to describe realities instead of wasting our breath in mere phrases. Moreover, this example shows how observation, sharpened by spiritual insight, enables us to look deeply into human life. Now let us return to Schiller. When we consider his life, two things strike us most of all, because they are so remarkable. There is an unfinished drama by Schiller, only a sketch. The title of that work is Die Malteser, the Maltese. Footnote, Friedrich Schiller's incomplete work, Die Malteser, was a dramatic tragedy based on the Turkish siege of Malta in 1530, end footnote. We see from the concept behind this sketch that if Schiller had wanted to complete his drama, he could have done so only as one who had experienced initiation. It could not have finished otherwise. To a certain degree, at least, he had the inner qualities needed for initiation. But because of other karmic conditions, these qualities could not get through. They were suppressed or cramped. There was a cramping of his soul life too, and this can be seen in his sketch of the Die Maltese. There are long, powerful sentences that never come to a full stop. Whatever is in him cannot find a way out. It is interesting to observe that for Goethe, too, we have unfinished sketches such as this, but in his case, when he left something unfinished, he did so because he was too easygoing to carry it any further. He could have finished it. This would have proved impossible for him only at a very advanced age after sclerosis had set in. For Schiller, however, we see another picture. He had an iron will when he tried to develop Die Maltese, but he could not do it. He could write only a slight sketch, because his drama, in reality, contains something that since the time of the Crusades has been preserved in the various kinds of occultism, mysticism, and initiation science. Schiller went to work on this kind of drama, but to complete it he would have had to experience initiation. This is truly a life's destiny that deeply moves those who are able to look behind such things and see into the real being of the person. Once it became known that Schiller intended to write a drama such as Die Maltese, there was a tremendous increase in opposition to him in Germany. He was feared. People feared that he might betray all kinds of occult secrets in his drama. I also want to say something about another work. Schiller was unable to finish Die Maltese. He could not get through it. He let time slip by, and he wrote all sorts of things that certainly warrant admiration. But these can be admired by any quote-unquote Philistine. If he had been able to complete Die Maltese, it would have called for the attention of individuals of the most powerful and vigorous minds. But he had to set it aside. After some time, he received a new impulse that inspired his later work. He could no longer think about Die Maltese, but began to compose Demetrius. It portrays a remarkable problem of destiny, the story of the false Demetrius, who takes the place of another man. To complete this story, Schiller would have to include all the story's conflicting destinies, emerging from hidden causes, and all the human emotions thus aroused. As he went to work on it with feverish activity, people became aware of it, and were even more afraid that certain things would be exposed, and they had an interest in keeping such matters hidden from the rest of humankind for some time yet. And now certain things occurred in Schiller's life that, for those who understand them, cannot be attributed to an ordinary illness. We have a remarkable picture of this illness. Something tremendous happened, not just in terms of its severity, but also in its shattering force. Schiller became ill while writing Demetrius. In a raging fever on his sick bed, he continually repeated almost all of Demetrius. It seemed as though an alien power was at work in him, expressing itself through his body. There is no ground for accusing anyone, of course, but despite everything written about this, we must look at the whole picture of this illness and conclude that one way or another, even in an essentially occult way, something contributed to the rapid culmination of Schiller's illness in death. We know that some people suspected this because Goethe, who was unable to do anything but suspect, refrained from participating personally in any way during Schiller's final days, not even after his death, although he felt it deeply. He did not dare to make his inner thoughts known. These remarks are intended only to point out that for anyone who can see through such things, Schiller was undoubtedly predestined to create works of a high spiritual order. But because of inner and outer karmic reasons, it was all held back, dammed up within him. I venture to say that for spiritual investigators, there is nothing more interesting than to study Schiller's achievements during the final 10 years of his life, from the aesthetic letters on, and then to follow the course of his life after death. A deep penetration of Schiller's soul after death reveals manifold inspirations coming to him from the spirit world. This is why Schiller had to die in his mid-40s. His condition of cramps and his build as a whole, especially the ugly formation of his head, made it impossible for him to incarnate physically the essence of his soul and spirit, which was deeply rooted in spiritual existence. Bearing such things in mind, we must acknowledge that the study of human life is deepened through the use of what spiritual science provides. We learn to see right into human life. In presenting these examples to you, my sole purpose was to show how one learns through anthroposophy to contemplate the life of human beings. Let us now look at the matter as a whole. Can't we deepen our feeling and understanding for everything human just by looking at an individual human life as we have done here? At a certain moment in life, if we can say, this is how it was for Schiller and Goethe and for the other young man I told you about, doesn't this stir something within our souls, teaching us to look at every child in a deeper way? Doesn't every human life become a sacred mystery to us? Will we learn to contemplate every human life, every human being, with much more inner attention? And because knowledge of the human being is instilled into our souls in this way, can't we deepen our love for humankind? And with this human love, doesn't our study of the human being give depth to the innermost sacred mystery of life? And with this love, won't we be able to truly enter the task of education, because life itself has become sacred to us? Won't the teacher's purpose be transformed from mere ideological phrases and dreamlike mysticism into a truly sacred calling, ready to do its work when divine grace sends human beings into earthly life? Everything depends on the development of such feelings. The essence of spiritual science is not mere theoretical teaching. We don't merely learn that human beings consist of physical, etheric, astral, and I beings, or that there are laws of karma, reincarnation, and so on. People can be very bright and know everything, but these are not anthroposophists in the true sense of the word. Just because they know these things in an ordinary way, as one might learn the contents of a cookbook. The important thing is for the life of human souls to be enlivened and deepened by the spiritual scientific worldview, and that we learn to work and act from a soul life that has been deepened and made alive. This is the first task in fostering education that is based on anthroposophy. From the very beginning, one should work in such a way that teachers and educators know the human being in the deepest sense, so that out of the conviction that arises from observing human beings correctly, they approach children with love that is born from such thinking. And so it follows that when teachers train to work in an anthroposophic way, we do not begin by saying you should do it like this or like that, or you should use this or that educational trick. First, we awaken a true educational sense, born from our knowledge of the human being. If we have been successful in awakening this real love of education in teachers, then we can say that they are ready to begin their work as educators. In education based on knowledge of the human being, as is Waldorf education, for example, the first thing to consider is not conveying rules or advice about how one is supposed to teach. The first thing is to hold training courses for teachers in such a way that we find the hearts of the teachers and deepen those hearts so that love for the children grows from them. It is natural for teachers to believe that they can, quote-unquote, impose such love on themselves, but imposed human love achieves nothing. There may be good intentions behind it, but it will achieve nothing. The only human love that can do anything arises from a deepened observation of individual cases. If you really wish to develop an understanding of the essential principles of education based on knowledge of the human being, whether you have already gained knowledge of spiritual science or, as also happens, you have an intuitive grasp of such matters, you will observe children in such a way that you are faced with a question: what is the main thrust of a child's development up to the change of teeth? An intimate study of the human being reveals that up to the change of teeth, children are completely different from what they become later on. A tremendous inner transformation takes place at this time, and another tremendous transformation occurs at puberty. Just consider what this change of teeth means for growing children. It is only the outer indication of deep changes that take place in the whole human being, changes that occur only once. We get our second teeth only once, not every 7 years. With the change of teeth, the formative process in the teeth ends. After this, we retain our teeth throughout life. The most we can do is have them filled or replace them with false ones, because our organism will not produce more. The reason for this is that with the change of teeth, the organization of the head is brought to a certain conclusion. If we are aware of this in each case and ask ourselves what is really being concluded with the change of teeth, we are led at this point to comprehend the whole human organization of body, soul, and spirit. And if we observe a child up to the change of teeth, with our view deepened by love gained through a knowledge of the human being as I have described, we see that it is during these years that children learn to walk, speak, and think. These are the three most outstanding faculties that are developed up to the change of teeth. Walking involves more than just learning to walk. Walking is only one manifestation of what actually takes place. It means learning to adapt to the world by gaining a sense of balance. Walking is only the most obvious expression of this process. Before learning to walk, children do not need equilibrium in the world, but now they learn this. How does it come about? It happens because we are born with a head that requires a certain position in relation to the forces of balance. We can see the secret of the human head very clearly in the physical body. Bear in mind that the average human brain weighs between 1 and 1.5 kilograms. If this much weight were to press down on the delicate veins at the base of the brain, we would quickly crush them. This is prevented because the weight of the brain floats in the cerebral fluid that fills the head. No doubt you recall from your studies in physics that a body floating in a fluid loses weight in proportion to the fluid that it displaces. Apply this to the brain, and you discover that our brain presses on its base with a weight of around 20 grams. The remaining weight is lost in the cerebral fluid. Thus at birth, the brain is positioned so that its weight will be in correct proportion to the displaced cerebral fluid. This is adjusted when we lift ourselves from crawling to an upright posture. The position of the head must now be brought into relationship to the rest of the organism. Walking and using our hands require the head to assume a certain position. Our sense of balance proceeds from the head. Let's take this a step further. At birth, our head is relatively highly organized. Until then, it is formed in the embryo, though it will not become fully developed until the change of teeth. It is the rhythmic system that is first established during the time before the change of teeth, when it receives its special outer organization. If you simply observe physiological processes more carefully, you can see the importance of establishing the circulatory and breathing systems during the first 7 years. Above all, you recognize how much damage can be done if the physical life of a child does not develop properly. We must face the fact, therefore, that in these first years of life, something is at work that is now establishing its own laws in the circulatory and breathing systems. Children sense unconsciously how their life forces work in their circulation and breathing. A physical organ, such as the brain, must establish a state of balance. Likewise, the soul, in the first years of life, plays a role in the development of the rhythmic systems. The physical body must actively bring about a state of balance proceeding from the head. The soul, to the degree that it is organized correctly for this purpose, must be active in the changes in the circulation and breathing. Our upright bearing and the use of our hands and arms are related to what is expressed in the brain. Similarly, speech develops in us in a way that is related to the systems of circulation and breathing. By learning to speak, we establish a relationship with our circulation and breathing. In the same way, we establish a relationship between walking and dexterity and the forces of the head by learning to hold the head so that the brain loses the correct amount of weight. If you learn to perceive these relationships and then meet someone with a clear, high voice particularly well suited to reciting hymns or odes or even to moral harangues, you can be certain that this is related to certain conditions of the circulatory system. Or if you meet someone with a rough, harsh voice, like beating sheets of brass and tin, you may be sure that this too is connected with the breathing or circulatory systems. But there is more to it than this. When we learn to listen to a child's voice, whether harmonious and pleasant or harsh and discordant, and when we understand that this is related to movements of the lungs and to the blood circulation, movements inwardly vibrating through the whole person, right into the fingers and toes, we know that this speech expresses something imbued with soul qualities. And now something like a quote-unquote higher being appears, finding expression in this image that relates speech to the physical processes of circulation and breathing. Beginning with this, we can look up and see into the prenatal human life that is subject to the conditions we claimed between death and a new birth. What one experienced in pre-earthly conditions plays a role here, and so we can see that if we are to comprehend the human being by means of true human understanding and knowledge, we must train to hear spiritually when we listen to children's voices. Then we know how to help a child whose strident voice betrays the fact that there is some kind of karmic obstruction, and we can do something to free that child from those karmic hindrances. All this enables us to see what is needed in education, nothing less than knowledge of the human being. This is not merely the kind of knowledge that recognizes a gifted child or which children are good or bad. This kind of knowledge follows up what a human being carries, for example, what is present spiritually in speech, tracing it right into the physical body, so that you are not faced with abstract spirituality, but the kind of spirituality that is expressed in the physical image of a human being. Then, as teachers, you can work in such a way that you consider both spirit and body, and thus can help the physical provide the right foundation for spirit. Furthermore, you might observe a child from behind and see that the legs are short, that the upper body is too heavy, and that this makes the child's walk too heavy. And thus, if you have acquired the right way of looking at these things, you recognize that the child's former earthly life and karma are speaking. Or you may see another expression of karma in someone who walks as did the German philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte, for example, who always walked with his heels placed firmly first. Even when he spoke, it seemed as though the words came out, quote-unquote, heel first. Thus we come to recognize karma in children through observation based on spiritual science. This is extremely important, and we must investigate and understand it. Our single aid as teachers is our ability to observe human beings, to observe the children's bodies, their souls, and their spirits. In this way, knowledge of the human being must make itself felt in education, and this knowledge must be deepened in soul and spirit. With this lecture, I wanted to invoke a picture that gives an idea of what we are trying to achieve in education. It can arise in the way of practical educational results, though many people consider it to be very impractical and fantastic daydreaming. The end of Lecture 2.